Thank you, Charlie. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
It's a real pleasure to be here. This is a big weekend for a primary purpose group, Fifth Tradition Group and Friendship Group in Beaufort. Flew a couple of big-time speakers from Vegas and Ontario. I'm glad y'all are here. I came from Gainesville, Georgia, so doesn't really compare as far as mileage goes, but I'm excited about being here. Thank you for having me. My sobriety date is April 30th, 2007, and my home group is the Monday night 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers Group at the NABA Club. And the NABA Club has been in existence since the 50s. They're located on Briarwood Road, which is off of the Claremont exit at I-85. So if you're familiar where the REI is, we're three doors down on Briarwood. And there's 45 meetings a week there, starting at 7:30, 7 days a week, 7:30 a.m. The meetings run up till 8 o'clock these days. We used to have a 10 o'clock meeting, but Triangle seems to get the late night business down there. And Biscayne Room, which is close by, also has a Saturday night 11:30 meeting. That being said, it's a great place to stop if you're stuck in traffic. So, you know, you got rush hour, that's the kind of happy hour I need. I can jump off, catch a 5:45 meeting, maybe stick around for an 8 o'clock meeting. It's where I got my sobriety. It's where I picked up my white shift. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. I treat it kind of like a university of alcoholism. I had to immerse myself into it. I didn't have anywhere else to go, and I had some family that thought that might be a good idea, and they dropped me off like it was daycare. And so far, it's worked out pretty good. Another thing NABA has is they serve a dinner on Thursday night, and they'll have a men's meeting and a women's meeting. And they got Al-Anon, they got Alateen, everything's happening there on Thursday night. It's a big deal, and one of the best dinners in town. And on Saturday mornings, we got the best breakfast going. Now, some folks like to start off with a joke, and I'm gonna do my best to tell you what I thought was a pretty good joke when I heard it. Two AAs by the name of Joe and Charlie. They were loving AA, and they said, you know, I wonder, you know, since it's a spiritual program, is there AA in heaven? I mean, do they got AA meetings? How are they running this, that, and the other? So I don't know, but I tell you what, why don't we make a deal? Whoever dies first, come back and tell the other what it's like, what AA is like in heaven. Joe dies. Day of his funeral, a couple of days later, Charlie's in bed. He looks up, and there's Joe standing at the foot of his bed. And he goes, what are you doing here? He goes, well, remember our deal? I was going to come back and tell you about AA in heaven. He goes, oh, yeah. What's it? Well, oh, it's the best. It's the best, man. The chips are made out of real gold. The coffee is best coffee. It's better than Starbucks. Their recovery is just fantastic. It's never been better. He says, I blew the joke. Good news and bad news. The good news is they had all that good stuff. So what's the bad news? You're our discussion leader tomorrow night. My sponsor's here tonight, and my sponsor took me to my first big book study, and that was over at 8111. And there was a woman named Lynn who ran that course, and she She really had a deep understanding of the Big Book, or at least since I knew nothing about it, it was just a lot of information. And when we got through to page 164 and we were basking in the glow of the Road of Happy Destiny, I said, Lynn, if you could just sum up this, all this we've gone over in a couple of sentences, could you do that? And she goes, well, I'll tell you this prayer. And I still remember this prayer this day, and I say it every day. And it's not in the Big Book, but it kind of wraps up the whole program for me. It says, God, help me help other people. And if there's some folks I can't help, let me do them no harm. So I just wanted to share that tonight. I hope I don't do anybody any harm tonight. That's the program in a nutshell. And I love it when I hear old-timers in the room, and I'm far from an old-timer. I'd say I'm a latecomer, because I didn't get sober until I was 53 years old, and I'm 61 today. I love it when an old-timer says, if I stick to the basics, I never have to go back to the basics. And that's what I try to do. I try to stick to the basics, at least what I understand them to be. And as time goes on, my understanding changes. It evolves. This is a very evolving program. You think you know it, and then you find out more. It just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. Reading the Big Book, I found that I can go to Big Book studies over and over and over and get something new, deeper meaning. I think it's probably the most elegant book ever written. There's not one word too many. And there's nothing left out in terms of treating our alcoholism. I mean, it's just a miracle, because I had Big Books. I was given Big Books for 20 years before I got sober, before I ever went to an AA meeting. I had girlfriends that I thought could fix me. I would always pick up this girl that didn't have a drinking problem. I didn't even pick up. I mean, I would focus on that person, and I would act sober. And I was sort of successful, and I would get tight with them. And then the holidays would come up, and then my true love, alcohol, would win out. And by the time Christmas came, my big present of the year would be a Big Book. I got a 12 and 12. I had a whole collection, and it wasn't just from one woman. I mean, and they would all go on the shelf, and I never read a thing about it. I knew I was an alcoholic. I said, what can you tell me that I don't already know? I know I can't not drink. But what I could do is I could drink daily, and I could drink in public and not make a spectacle out of myself. But I would disappear on people. I'd be like out, be 10 o'clock at night or something, and everybody about to say goodnight or this, that, and the other, and I'd just disappear. And I'd head home, and I'd drink myself into oblivion. And I would do that unless I was involved in a relationship, and sooner or later I would screw that up. And this just went on from the time I was a youngster, through my marriage, through becoming a father, through three or four engagements. And alcohol was my true love. I could go on the wagon with the best of them. I could go a few days. I could go a few weeks. I'd go a couple of months. And in the end, I'm 52 years old. I have a family member who's really at the end of their life, and I volunteered to be their caregiver, and I couldn't take care of them because I would pass out, and when they needed help, I wasn't available. Instead of going to get help, I just got on my knees one day and I said, God, help me. Help me not drink. And I didn't drink. I prayed morning and night, and it was all intuition. I had not opened any of those big books, so I really didn't understand my disease. But it's amazing. Prayer will help. And what happened in my case is that when the cravings went away, as they will eventually do, or at least in my case they did, I stopped praying. I'd look myself in the mirror and I'd say, I've got willpower. I got this thing licked. And I quit drinking on a Thanksgiving. The next Thanksgiving, I still hadn't had a drink. I was kind of watching that calendar, and my family was so proud of me. Actually, I went about 2 months without mentioning that I wasn't drinking, but they noticed a change in me after a couple of months, as people do. And so, how long? I said, well, I stopped on Thanksgiving. Well, that Thanksgiving, they had an AA chip, and they gave me my first AA chip. One year. And it was a bronze medallion. I looked at it and I was like, I didn't need AA. And I sat it on my dresser and I thanked everybody, but you know, and I was trying to be gracious, but I knew I didn't really earn that chip. I knew nothing about AA. It was just like they had given the I don't know, but it didn't mean anything. The chip meant nothing. And about a week later, I had a friend of mine who was a drinking buddy drop dead. And this guy, he had gotten 2 DUIs within about an hour and a half out of Poor Richards in Norcross, Georgia. He lived right down the street. Somehow he got out of jail, and they took him home, and he went back up there and got in his car again. And so he lost his license for 10 years. He married his designated driver, young lady, would drive him around, his girlfriend, and they got married. And she was his chauffeur for like 10 years. He got his driver's license back, and celebrating, he dropped dead. So I'm at his funeral, and he's laid out there, and I mean, he's puffy, red-faced, lifetime of drinking. I'm standing there basically 13 months without a drink. A friend that was a mutual friend that was a working associate who was not an alcoholic, and I knew this because we would drink beer at work, and when I would pick up the beer cans from his desk, there would always be more than half of the beer left on his desk every time. I always worked at computer businesses where 4:30 we did beer runs. It was beer 30. We had a few beers before we'd leave the office. Eddie, who was not a problem drinker, said, how are you doing? I said, how am I doing? I'm good. He goes, really? He looks back over at the guy in the casket. And I said, you mean about my drinking? And he goes, yeah, how's that going? And I said, oh, I haven't had a drink in over a year. He goes, wow, you must be one of them AA miracles. I said, no, never been to an AA meeting. I guess people might need something like that, but I don't need that. I got willpower. I don't need to work with other alcoholics, I don't think. He looked at me like, well, I was either the biggest fool there ever was. He looked at me like he was worried that I was going to go down hard. And I could tell that he was thinking that. And I got in my car an hour later, and I pulled that rearview mirror down. I looked myself in the eye and said, you've got willpower. You beat that thing. You don't have to drink. And then I drove home, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I started romancing a drink. I said, well, maybe I can't. Maybe I haven't. Even though every time I romanced a drink, thinking that I'd learn, I had one drink and I was off to the races before I knew it. And then Christmas came up, had family over. I went to the wine collection and I basically sold a bottle of wine. I said, hey everybody, this wine, right? No sulfites. It's from Europe and blah, 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 and all of this, you know, tannins. I can't remember what I said, but everybody's like, oh, well, open it, let's have some. So I poured everybody a glass, and I set the bottle down, and I had an aunt who said, well, what about you? Aren't you going to have some? I said, no, I can't. I haven't had a drink in over a year. And she goes, oh, well, that's too bad. Well, if you haven't had a drink in over a year, surely you can join us. This is Christmas, a special occasion. So I poured myself a half a glass of wine. And I really didn't drink it. I took one sip at the toast and sat it down. The spell was gone after that, because I romanced that idea. I mean, I thought, well, maybe I have learned not to drink. Maybe I can drink and get away with it. A couple of weeks later, after dwelling on it in my head, I had a drink. Next day, I had a drink. The day after that, I had two drinks. And then it was on. Then I just couldn't, I didn't even mess with the bar. I went straight to the liquor store and went home. In the meantime, not having had anything to drink for over a year, I had this cash, and I live on Lake Lanier, and I got kayaks and canoes and all kinds of water toys, but I said, I want a bass boat. My son loves to fish. I found a bass boat, and with all that money I'd saved, I put it into a bass boat. I went out fishing, had the worst time of my life, sober, white knuckle, no AA, not drinking. That same time I'm romancing that I can drink. So what I need is a cooler beer. I gotta have a cooler beer. I got my tunes together, got the stereo, got the bass boat going. Within a week, I found myself waking up floating on the side, outside the boat, out in the middle of the lake, passed out drunk. I'd fallen off the boat somehow. Had a dog with me. The dog's whimpering. I look around, no shore patrol. I said, oh, man, wow. Get back in the boat and said, if I ever do this again, I'm going to stop drinking. Next day, I did it again. I wasn't in the same spot on the lake, but I came to floating for the second day in a row. And the dogs get kind of fed up with this. So I go home and I go, well, you know, I said I'd quit drinking. Well, I couldn't quit drinking. So I go back out on the bass boat the next day, and I said, well, I'll just take a six pack with me. And I see this tree limb, or maybe it was the base of the tree, or whatever, but it looked like a gondola pole. And I was having a hard time with my electric motor for trolling around the on the banks of the lake. So I grabbed that pole, and it's like 15 feet long, and it's strong, and it's pretty clean. And it laid all the way across the boat from the back, and it stuck out about 3 feet. And I started using it fishing, and not worrying about the trolling motor. I was like, well, that's kind of neat. So then I said, well, I'm going to go upriver. So I start flying, and by the time I'm drinking a little bit, I'm doing some other, and I go right past the signs of the shallows where the Chattahoochee River feeds Lake Lanier. I live up on the north end of the lake. The water gets about that deep, and I'm flying, going 40 miles an hour past the warnings, not noticing them. And then finally, my prop starts hitting the sand, and I try to turn it around, and I get stuck, and I'm a half mile upriver, and I'm just beached. And there's no way to get that bass boat out of there. And I look in my cooler, I got two beers left. I got that gondola pole, and I was able to take that pole, first trying to get out of the boat and push it, thinking if I got out, I could push it. I couldn't push it. I got it out, and I was just pulling it, and that thing would move like a half inch. So it's about 2 in the afternoon, and I finally got into the main water about 11:30 that night. And I had not done my beer run at that point. Now, I had other alcohol in the house, but I really liked my beer at the time. And so I was fixated. I got to have what I got to have. And I try to get to the gas station. I get to the gas station 15 seconds too late. And the guy goes, "No, can't have it. We have an argument. This is ridiculous. You don't know what I've been through." The world. "This is just unfair, you know." And the guy's like, "Dude, go away." Sitting out on a lonesome highway out in North Georgia. This crazy man. I still didn't stop drinking. And then I started blacking out driving. And I go down to Whole Foods going, "Maybe I can get some drops, rescue remedy." So I'm buying Rescue Remedy. Well, there's 27% alcohol in Rescue Remedy. If you don't know what that is, it's supposedly a homeopathic treatment. It's supposed to help you. Well, I was drinking that stuff like half pints. Then I noticed they got this wine, and it's organic, and it's white and red wine from Europe, organic, and it's $2.78. $2.78. There's got to be a mistake. There's no wine coming from Europe that's organic that's $2.78. So I buy the whole display. Pack up my car. I mean, throw it on the credit card. Get it home. I said, "I wonder if they got any more. This ain't so bad." I bought some mineral water. I was doing spritzers. I never was a spritzer guy, but I said, "Well, I better get this while the getting's good." So I go back, I said, and there's another display just like it. So I load up my car again. This goes on all week, and I end up buying $2,000 of $2 wine. I got wine coming in. Listen, I'm warehoused. I'm like that wine collection I always dreamed of having. It was insanity. And then I couldn't stand it. It turned on me. It was like I'd never be able to drink this again. And there I am looking at just boxes and boxes of wine. It's just like, I mean, I put orange juice on it. It just nothing would help. And it was like just. So I was really getting depressed. And about that time, I started thinking, I'm definitely hopeless. And for the first time in my life, I thought about suicide and immediately dismissed it because, for one, I was chicken. Two, I was worried about family members who would find me. And I was so isolated at that point, I might be months before anybody ever found me. And I just was like, that's, you know. So I didn't do that, but I would pray to God. The only prayer I prayed at that time was, "Please don't let me wake up." And I did that for about 3 days. And I seriously thought that my liver, it felt like a brick. And I thought that I was just going to just go away. And they'd find me in bed or something. So he died of natural causes. But $2,000 worth of $2 wine surrounding him. Guess they would have figured something out. But my sister shows up one day, who's an Al-Anon. She said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm not so good." She's going, "What you mean?" I said, "I can't stop drinking." She goes, "You haven't had a drink in, you know, a year and a half." And I said, No, I've been hyped out. I've been drinking for 4 months now. I've been blacking out, waking up on 985 with the engine running and falling out of my bass boat. I mean, I'm the biggest mess I've ever been." And she goes, "Well, I know what we're going to do." I said, "Oh, okay." She goes, "Go to Betty Ford's?" I thought I was going to go off to some fancy rehab place. She goes, "No, just pack a bag. I'll take you to Atlanta. You won't be up here for a while." So I packed up, and she dragged me straight down to a Monday night meeting at NAMA. Walked in, And that lobby, if you've been in the lobby at NAVA, all the presidents from the, you know, for the last 50 years are on the wall. You feel like you're walking in an institution of some kind. There's AA archives set out in the lobby, and I'm looking at all this, and I'm going, oh my God, this is not good. They said, come on, come on, come on. They dragged me into the big room. They'd already done the readings, and it was sit down behind the speaker that night. He looked familiar. He was wearing a nice jacket, had a pretty good haircut. He didn't look anything like me at the time. I was a mess. He was introduced, and his name was David C. from Sandy Springs. And I didn't even pick up on that in the beginning. He's telling his story. Well, I went to Sandy Springs High School. I graduated there in 1971. And David's telling his story, and he's talking about the treehouse where he and the rest of his 12-year-old buddies used to get cases of beer on the weekend, marijuana, other things delivered by his big sister's boyfriend, which was me. That's my very first AA meeting. And that's what I walk into. God ambushed me with that one, I'm telling you. I was like, because I'm involved in a speaker meeting, which I'll tell you more about, but that was my very first AA meeting. It was the speaker meeting. But I've heard other speakers say that they sat in the rooms for a little while and then somebody told their story, that they were in the story. Well, I was definitely in the story. And I was busted. And I knew that when they offered that white chip, I didn't get up to pick it up at first. I was stunned. And when they said, one last chance on the white chip, I said, well, you know, if I don't pick up a white chip right now, I'm never going to get help. And so I picked up my white chip, and I met my sponsor, Tim, who's sitting right here. That night, he was running that meeting. He's run that meeting for the last 10 years. And that was back on April 30th, 2007. Tim said, hey, man, we really need you. We need you. Just keep coming back, man. He actually said, we need you maybe more than you need us. I hadn't been wanted or needed in so long. My son was 28 years old, and he had never known a sober parent. And he was fed up with me. His mother had had a couple of marriages since then. She was fed up with me. Every relationship I had after my divorce, they didn't have anything to do with me. And then total stranger says, we need you more than you might need us. And I wanted to be needed. That was just the right thing to hear. And then I went up to David, and he recognized me immediately. He goes, Tim Ridgway, wow, man, you look terrible. When did you go back out? I said, go back out? What do you mean? He goes, well, you've had to have been in AA by now, knowing you. And I'm like, no, this is my first AA meeting. He goes, oh, man, well, I can't be your sponsor. We are too much history. I'm like, okay, I heard you mention a sponsor in your story. You talked about a sponsor, so that's part of the deal. And he goes, yeah, but I can't do it. And he said, now my sponsor sponsors a lot of people. He can't take you on as a sponsor, but I do recommend that you call him and let him talk to you. And his name is Bill Sanders. And Bill Sanders is involved in the Mount Vernon group, and he's the chairperson for the Atlanta Men's Workshop, which is held at Rock Eagle twice a year in the fall and spring. and has been so for, gosh, 30-some-odd years now, I guess. I called Bill and left my name on his voicemail, and his voicemail says, "And have a great day unless you've got other plans." I'm like, I think I got other goings on, but, you know, I was amazed. In 5 or 10 minutes, he called me back, and he's got this radio voice. He was a WSB newsman, and he did all kinds of commercials. He was the original Delta, "We're ready when you are." He did that campaign and interviewed presidents in the United States when they came to Atlanta. Bill calls up and he goes, and he's the director of the Georgia Radio Hall of Fame. He calls up and he says, "Well, how are you doing, Tim?" And I said, "I'm doing fine." He goes, "Really? That's why you picked up a white chip last night." I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I guess I'm not doing so good." And he goes, "Yeah, yeah, one of the things, we got to get honest, you know, in the program." I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "How do you really feel?" And that was really the first time I opened up and talked to somebody how I really felt. And he had some great suggestions. And one of the things was, he asked me where I was staying, and this, that, and the other, and it made sense that I spend a little time at NABBA. And he just said, "Take your time. You're going to see a lot of folks. You need to get a sponsor as soon as possible, but don't just, you know." I just didn't have to grab somebody for a sponsor. And as it turned out, when I got sober, there were a lot of people that were looking for sponsees. It was like rush week on Campus Row at the fraternity houses. I mean, everybody was like, "You got a sponsor?" "No." "I'm your sponsor." "No." "You're not my sponsor. Sorry." And so I watched, and I kept going back to the speaker meeting. And after a couple of weeks, I called Tim up and asked him to be my sponsor. And he was, yeah, we'll do this thing. We'll do this thing. First thing I want you to do is get involved with the speaker meeting. And we need help putting this thing on." And I was like, "I don't know what I can do." He said, "Well, we need somebody to run the recording equipment." And it may not have been right that week. Maybe he wouldn't have trusted me with that at that point. But after a little while, I started recording the speakers. And boy, we had a great chairperson at the Troy. Is a triangle guy. What's his home group, Tim?
Probably Saturday morning midweek.
Yeah, Saturday morning. You know, after a year or so, we had somebody else scheduled to do it. He didn't show up, and I chaired my first. And I kind of hogged the podium for a while. And we try to share it as much as possible these days. But we have a website where there's over 250 speakers that have let us record them. And we've got a really good group. I know you guys do similar things, but we have Bill Roop a couple of times before he died. Bill Roop, 55 years of sobriety. Came from Chicago. He knew all the early old-timers. Helen Rowe of the Central Office, Helen Moore, Ann McDonald, some folks that have really made a big impact in AA. We were able to get them, get their stories out there, in a lot of cases, get their memorial services out there. But we also get a lot of newcomers. And they say that newcomers are lifeblood of the program. But they also say that old-timers are the arteries of the program. I believe that to be true. And I'm not really a newcomer or an old timer. Like I said, I'm a latecomer. I really didn't get back into all the things that got me started down the road of being an alcoholic. But in my case, I believe that maybe the fact that I started smoking cigarettes when I was 9 years old and had a pack a day habit by the time I was 10, knowing I couldn't smoke in front of my parents, and there was no way I could afford that habit, so I learned how to lie, cheat, and steal. So all those behaviors that those character defects were tightly ingrained in me by the time I could get my hands on alcohol. And I did have alcoholism in my family. My mother's brother, we had a lot of Cherokee Indian on my mother's side, and my mother's brother, if he didn't drink, he was the greatest guy, what a sweetheart. When he drank, he was the devil, and he would just get so polluted. And she said, we're going to teach our kids how to drink, like ladies and gentlemen. I had a little sister. And all the holidays, they would set all this fine china and crystal, and they would have the white wine and the red wine, port, after dinner drinks. And they would say, okay, take a bite of the quail and put a little white wine with that. Get a little bit of the beef, the roast beef, and put a little red wine with that. It'll help you digest. And I was like, this is ruining the taste of my food. But I, you know, all I wanted was the effect. So I would volunteer to clear the table. And I had a Slurpee cup, and I would pour everybody's leftover wine in the Slurpee cup, and then fill it up with ice, put a straw in it, and say, I've got to go do my homework. And I'd get, the bed would be spinning, I'd be hanging on tight. And I think that started when I was about 10 or 11. And so Christmas, Thanksgiving, all the dove hunt, whatever. Anytime we had an excuse for that, I was getting a buzz on. So I knew that I wanted to get buzzed. We were allowed to drink at home. And my stepfather drank a ton, but he didn't slur his words. He was a John Wayne kind of drinker. So I tried to emulate him, and I kept up with him until I was 53. But I'm 61 today. He died of liver cancer when he was 60. I probably should have. I found out 3 years after I got sober that I had stage 4 cancer. I had a large tumor that was located in my colon, and they found cancer in my liver and all through my lymphatics. But I hadn't had a drink in about 3 years, and I didn't panic. If I was going to die, I was going to die. I had gotten to the point where I was praying and meditating. I was truly doing the 11 step. I had a few sponsees. I was working with them. Okay. I got cancer. Well, it turned out I qualified for a program in Hall County that helped me with the financial part of that. So I didn't have that to worry about so much. A lot of paperwork. But that was my full-time job, was recovering from cancer and going to AA meetings. And today, it's been 3 years, and it's in full remission. And they keep checking me every 6 months. My last report was the best report I've ever gotten. So, grace of God is definitely a miracle. I'm not the only one that beats the cancer rap these days. If you know somebody who's got cancer, or if you're faced with it, there's definitely hope and there's things you can do. And one of the things is don't drink. The other thing is maybe improve your diet and lifestyle a little bit. That worked for me. Step one, when I got here, I found this the finishing passage in the 12 and 12 to be absolutely true. Why all this insistence that every AA must hit bottom first. The answer is that few people will sincerely try to practice the AA program unless they have hit bottom. For practicing AA's remaining 11 steps means the adoption of attitudes and actions that almost no alcoholic who is still drinking can dream of taking. Who wishes to be rigorously honest and tolerant? Who wants to confess his fault to another and make restitution for harm done? Who cares anything about a higher power, let alone meditation and prayer? Who wants to sacrifice time and energy in trying to carry AA's message to the next sufferer? No, the average alcoholic, self-centered in the extreme, doesn't care for this prospect unless he has to do these things in order to stay alive himself. Under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA, and there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. Then, and only then, do we become open-minded to conviction and as willing to listen as the dying can be. We stand ready to do anything that will lift the merciless obsession from us. You know, the principle behind that step is honesty. You finally have to realize you can't go on. I couldn't. I just said, I can't go on. And the second step, the principle, is hope. We found that soon we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves. We commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend the power, which is God. That's from We Agnostics, page 46. I could accept that, but I really, when I hit step three, I didn't feel worthy. I knew there was a God the whole time, and then I made decisions knowing that there would be consequences, but I made them anyway. So when I read the step, a decision turned my life and will over care of God, I was like, I don't deserve this. Tim said, move on, get into step four. Everybody does that. And I was a hard head. I was like, no, I got to learn the prayer. It's only three lines long. I'm going to learn this prayer, and then I'm going to start on step four. Well, in the meantime, I'm going to meetings. I've got a dollar or two in my pocket. I'm throwing a dollar in the basket. I might have a dollar left over. I go to Quick Trip, and I'm starving, and they've got hot dogs for a dollar. And they got these styrofoam containers, and I'm cramming two wieners and a hot dog bun and closing that thing up and giving them a dollar because I'm hungry. Well, I do that enough, I'm not hungry anymore, but it's like, I start doing it every day, just every day. I'm eating these hot dogs, which probably gave me cancer because I'm just eating. I'm living on hot dogs. Stolen hot dogs. Trying to learn the third step prayer. But knowing I'm stealing, I can't. It ain't working. And then one day I go in there and they got see-through containers. So I guess it'd been a shrinkage problem. But there's no place to put that second wiener, you know? I bought a hot dog for a dollar with one wiener. And I didn't steal any more hot dogs. And after about 4 days, I learned the third step prayer. It's just, you know, sequence of events. But I got it at that point. Also, when Tim was worried about me, he said, let's do the third step prayer together. We get down on our knees, saying the third step prayer. I get a leg cramp. I keel over to the side. I'm like convulsing on the floor. He thought I had a heart attack. I was not in good shape at the time. He's going, we don't have to do this thing. I said, I want to, I want to, I want to. These guys are, relax, man, relax. And that's one thing. As I got further along, did the fourth step, got into the prayer and meditation, the 11-step prayer, I asked God to direct my thinking today so that it be divorced of self-pity, dishonesty, self-seeking, self-will, and fear. Guide my thinking, decisions, and intuitions. help me to relax and take it easy. Free me from doubt and indecision. Guide me through this day. Show me the next step. Show me the solution to any problem I may face today. I ask all these things to be of maximum service to thee and my fellows. In the name of the steps, I pray. Amen. Thanks.